pages I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 518 of Unwelcome Guests, The Mendacity of Hype. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we're looking at information which has been processed for consumption by big money. Whether that's a government, a military, a marketing campaign, it's all pretty much the same methods. I've never been a great watcher of television, consumer of movies, reader of newspapers, and if you're listening to this show, you're probably not a great fan of commercial media either. But I dare say you regularly meet people who look to the haunted fish tank in the corner to tell them truth, who believe what is produced by the corporate press without much questioning, and who never ask themselves what they are not being told by the masters of spin. So I hope this show will help you spread some awareness about how media messages are concocted and how the need to present a facade that suits the power hierarchies distorts the messages and distorts what is actually happening. Our first speaker tonight knows, of course, that lying about what is happening or staging events is only half the story, that a potentially more significant failing to report the truth is just that, a failure to address some topics. He's Peter Phillips from Project Censored, which has a great website that you might want to check out at projectcensored.org, with a lot of interesting leads for stories that you will never find in the corporate media. He's speaking at the Understanding Deep Politics conference in Santa Cruz, May 2010, on what he calls the Global Truth Emergency.
35 years ago, when Project Censored was started, there were, at that time, 50 major media corporations in the United States that dominated the news. Over the years, we're now down to 10. So, analysis of how come news stories aren't covered, one of the best was Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman that was done 21 years ago. And they talked about how the corporate media is locked into capitalism, that they're locked into advertisers, bottom line orientation for making money, that they continue to consolidate, they support a strong market economy, and they tend to avoid certain types of stories because of their self-interest. And that was called the propaganda model, kind of a theoretical structural model of media. And that worked pretty good for quite a while. We would use that, particularly in the 90s, early 90s. But since 9/11, we have a whole different understanding of what's going on in corporate media. And it's more along the lines of a deliberate propaganda model of news and information. And we're going to cover some of the things that really lead us to that. I think one of the first issues that really got us thinking that there's something seriously wrong here, it's not just a structural issue, but it's deliberate, was how the ACLU in 2005 had been pushing the U.S. military, the Pentagon, to release autopsy reports of civilians who died in Iraq during the first 2 years of the war. And they had to threaten court. I mean, they had the right under the Freedom of Information Act, but the Pentagon was really dragging their feet. Finally, they got copies of 44 autopsy reports. Now, these autopsy reports were the U.S. military doctors' examinations of the bodies after somebody died while in U.S. custody, civilians. So in October of 2005, they released a press release, and they said, well, of the 44 autopsy reports, 23 of those listed the cause of death as homicide. And these were multiple sites. And now, this wasn't just Abu Ghraib. I mean, it was multiple sites in Afghanistan and Iraq. The conditions of the body clearly indicated, and doctors had verified that these people were tortured to death. Extensive bruises, contortions, broken bones, strangulation, just really awful stuff. The rest of the bodies, the rest of the autopsy reports, the primary cause of death was heart failure. while being tortured. And, you know, these were young people. So this was really, for the first time, absolute proof that we were torturing people to death on a wide scale, not just embarrassing them or having dogs snip at them and that, but really beating and killing people. And ACLU, with their press release, put this out, and AP picked it up. Associated Press, which reaches a billion people in the world, they put this out on their wire service to all 1,700 daily newspapers in the United States, to all 5,000 radio and television news programs across the country. And LexisNexis checks and further examination, we found out that 99.5% of them did not run the story. So LA Times had it on page A4. Seattle paper had it buried inside a larger story in Iraq, and the rest were small Midwest papers that actually covered it. So that meant that 1,600 plus newspaper editors saw that story and decided not to run it. Now, we don't know why, but they just decided that maybe they thought it would be unseen as unpatriotic, or the American people wouldn't believe it, that we were torturing people to death. Whatever the reason, we know that this was a factual decision. So this wasn't just the high levels of MSNBC or Fox or that making a decision. This was right down inside of grassroots media in the U.S. today. And that really kind of set us back a bit. And we started to think about what that means and the degree to which an American empire will go to propagate and push and continue to push global capital power worldwide. We know that in the U.S. prisons, we have 2 million people incarcerated, most for nonviolent offenses. And that we have a new story this year that came from Op-Ed News that talks about torture in prisons, beatings, isolations, imprisonment, torture itself, electric shock, prolonged exposure to heat, shackled prisoners lying for hours in their own cells across the country. That's not how we think of ourselves as a society. We now know that the immigration control people, ICE, they are holding thousands of U.S. residents in unlisted and unmarked subfield offices. This came out of The Nation magazine this year. They admit that they have 186 unmarked subfield offices. Now, these are suburban offices, sometimes commercial spaces that are rented. It could be a room like this where they would pack in hundreds of people and hold them there for days with no facilities, no drinking water, I mean, no beds, just places to house people, to hold them, to lock them up. The goal this year, according to ICE field director, is to deport 400,000 people. That's their goal this year. These are not just criminals. They say they're targeting people who have done crimes, but this is their goal. That's the goal. So you have a network across the country that utilizes local police to identify people, often based on the color of their skin, and then pulling them, literally pulling them off the street. In fact, there was this one quote from James Pendergraph, who was executive director of ICE a couple years ago. He said, "If you don't have enough evidence to charge somebody criminally, but you think they're illegal, we can make them disappear." Now, the Obama administration has been expanding this controversial 287G program so that local police, and this is kind of the model for what's going on in Arizona. So we're building, we have a criminal justice system. We've got prisons all over. Now we have secret detention centers. And then these people are deported through deportation courts that there's no public access allowed. So if someone's picked up off the street, they don't get to see a lawyer. The family doesn't know where they are. They don't get to make a phone call. They're moved around from place to place and can actually disappear. And that's the level to which the systems we're building in the U.S. operate. Now, Obama's also talking about doing DNA testing on not everybody that's convicted, but everybody who's arrested, to build a DNA database on all people mixed in with law enforcement in the country. Now, this on top of the practices that have been going on since 2005 called FALCON, federal and local cops organized nationally, which are nothing other than practices for mass arrest in this country. We have now mass arrests will coordinate 960 agencies, federal, Justice Department, Homeland Security, FBI, Secret Service, IRS, have taken a list of, the first list was 10,000 people supposedly with felony arrest warrants, coordinated with the state police, county sheriff's office, your local SWAT teams, all under one structured, coordinated mechanism of mass arrest. Now, we've done that multiple times. Over 90,000 people as of this year have been arrested in these mass arrest practices. So not only can we make people disappear, but we have a coordinated top-down mechanism for grabbing a whole lot of people really quickly. Those worry us. These are systems of oppression that can impact everybody. the fact that habeas corpus now can be suspended for any person in the United States based upon the decision of the president, the person's an enemy of the state. So you don't have to have done anything. Obama can simply say that those people in conspiracy groups are untrustworthy, and here's their names, and they can be treated just like an illegal immigrant. And except immigrants aren't illegal, they just don't have papers. It's not against the law, technically. And they can be arrested and held without an attorney, without rights of habeas corpus. And that's law today. It's established law. It's all been done under Homeland Security and under the Bush administration, but Obama hasn't changed a thing. So we're moving in this direction where Chris Hedges was interviewing Chomsky last month, and Chomsky's using the fascism word. He's saying that we have a serious problem. They're looking more and more like the Weimar Republic in Germany in the 30s. And that this is where the social democrats and the communists had basically disappeared, were killed and murdered. And the magnitude of murder is quite evident. With our invasion of Iraq, there's been three national surveys done on the number of civilian deaths in Iraq since the beginning of the war. Two by Johns Hopkins University, 2003-2006, and then one by Opinion Business Research Group out of Great Britain. Now, these were surveys where they went out, the one in 2007 went out, interviewed 2,400 families in Iraq in 15 of the 18 provinces. They didn't go into the most violent ones. And one of the questions was, has someone in your family died from war violence? And they were able to extrapolate from that data at the 99% accuracy level the entire deaths in Iraq. And they said at that time, and this was 2007, that there's been 1 million civilian deaths in Iraq because of the war. Now, these aren't deaths because somebody got sick and died. These were war violence deaths. And this is 1 million people in excess of what had been the death rate under Saddam Hussein. Now, the Johns Hopkins study also has people how they died. And their 2006 survey was quite clear that half of them died either by aerial bombing or U.S. firefights. So we've killed 500,000 people. Our forces have killed 500,000 people in Iraq and displaced 5 million more. That's mass murder. I mean, that is mass killings of people. And you won't find those figures in any newspaper in the country. You won't see those figures on any television program. The million figure was reviewed, the methods were reviewed by MIT. The Nation magazine last January, a year ago January, published the results from the MIT's review, said, yep, 1 million dead Iraqis. It doesn't get carried out there. It doesn't get talked about. It doesn't get engaged. The level of people that are dying. Instead, what we got a year ago, April, was a press release that came out of AP out of Baghdad that said government sources inside Baghdad say that the number of civilian casualties since at that time, they said 2005, were 87,000. And the total civilian casualties for the war were 110,000. Now, that story ran nationwide last April. They re-released the same story in July, and they re-released the same story again in October. That is deliberate lying. That is deliberate top-down propaganda. That's not just avoidance of a story like the torture stop. This is deliberately misinforming us. Instead, in November 2008, they had a story, AP put out a story, that hundreds of stray dogs are killed in Baghdad. But we can't find out about the civilian death rates. That's top-down propaganda. That's deliberate. That's the Pentagon. That's the public relations firms that work for the Pentagon and the U.S. government. And this is global. This isn't just the U.S. Our media systems are global. And we have to start thinking globally in terms of our resistance. The Defense Department is the worst polluter on the planet. They have contribute more to global warming, just the Iraq war, than 60% of the rest of the world. Just the Iraq war. Deadly substance, pesticides, defoliants, petroleum, lead, mercury, depleted uranium, one of the worst. And we did the depleted uranium story about 5 years ago, and it was in the top 10. And just after it came out, the Pentagon re-released a story saying depleted uranium wasn't harmful. Yet the birth defects in Fallujah last year were 25%. One out of four kids was born with a birth defect in Iraq. And if they're spiraling. And they're showing that this is related to this radioactivity that we're leaving there that's going to be around for 500,000,000 years. It's permanent radiation in whole swaths of Afghanistan and Iraq and Serbia, for that matter. So we're not only polluting the world, creating more CO2 gases than most of the countries, but the military is completely exempt from any environmental regulations by the U.S. government. They can do whatever they want. We've got 1,000 military bases worldwide. We spend more on weapons and warfare than the rest of the world combined. And we're in partnerships with NATO. So NATO and the U.S., with all these bases, are the protectors of global corporate capitalism. They're the protectors of the World Bank, the neoliberal things, and the shock doctrine process that Naomi Klein writes about. That's the agenda. That's the opposition. Those are the oppressors that we all collectively share. We're going to do a $15 billion buildup in Guam. We don't know this. Massive expansion buildup, military bases there. At the same time, worldwide, in terms of security, the World Bank now admits that 3 billion people live on less than $2.50 a day. That 44% of those, over a billion, live on less than $1.25 a day. So this means no phone calls, no nutritious food, no vacations, no television, no dental care, no inoculations. That's the structure of inequality. And that structure is maintained by the global military empire and corporate capitalism worldwide. And I'm not saying capitalism negatively. I'm talking about the big, huge corporate entities that are larger than most nations. And they're the ones that benefit, rob, and create this kind of poverty. As we understand that, and we understand that they're a piece of that, that this empire is a repression that addresses all of us. So these post 9/11 top-down decisions, military empire, are working very closely with newly expanding public relation groups that are feeding us this propaganda. There's three major groups since 2001 have been publicly merging. The largest is Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Group. These firms employ 163,000 people in 170 countries. They create the news. They will actually manufacture news or write up stories with a spin, depending on who's paying them. So this is a lot of the ones that we knew from before. Young and Rubicon, Burston Marsteller, Ogilvy and Mather, Worldwide, Helen Nolan. Helen Nolan was the one that brought us, during the first Iraq war, the young woman before Congress named Nayira, who testified how she was a nurse in the Kuwaiti hospital, and she watched the Iraqi soldiers come in and dump the babies out of the incubators on the cold floor to die and steal the incubators and take them back to Baghdad. And she said this with tears flowing down her face in front of Congress and television. And we were all outraged and, oh, this is terrible. And it wasn't true. It was a choreographed. She is trained. She was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador. She was trained by Helen Nolan with the full knowledge of the White House. So that kind of deliberate lying, that's what we're up against. It's the Rendon Group creating the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein after the invasion. It's the Jessica Lidge story. The young private who was injured in the hospital, and they Rendon gets them to delay going to get her because they sent the hospital call, hey, we got one of your soldiers, come get her. And they had to throw the special forces going in and follow that on national TV. So we get this big story about Jessica Lynch. The same day, the rest of the world is finding out that we shelled the Palestine Hotel and killed journalists there. The tanks are rolling into Baghdad, and we bombed Al Jazeera and killed one of their journalists. But we get Jessica Lynch. So there's a deliberate diversion. Deliberate diversion of news stories or taking things out of the mix. Where's the Gulf oil thing now? Do you find it on like page 8? And they're saying it's anywhere between 5,000 or 200,000. And the magnitude's incredible and they can't fix it. And the BP is going to say, oh, well, we're going to cover it all. It could be $1 trillion, according to Wayne Mason. BP isn't even worth that much. So this disaster that's going on right now is devastating. They're doing everything they can to kind of protect capital globally in that respect. So we find is that these big PR firms and the big media groups are working hand in hand to create the news top down. And on the boards of directors are all of these big corporations, the banks, the military industrial companies, the Carlyle Group, Bechtel, Boeing, Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, all have people on the boards of directors of the biggest media groups in this country. And they're interlocked worldwide. So there is this rift between reality reporting, and it's peaking. There's no longer just a credibility gap, but there's this terminology we've been using for 3 years now, this truth emergency. And it's not only keeping things concealed, but deliberately putting out misinformation. Deliberate countering as we come up with news and information. We're saying 1 million dead Iraqis, all of these things. Deliberately countering that. DU is not harmful to you, things like that. So it does create a reality that means that you can't tell what's real on television. It's like going to Disneyland. You know you're really there and you know it's not real. So that's this term, hyper-reality. And it's emotional and it's titillating and it's gossipy. And you kind of can get excited about the stuff that's going on. There's lots of visual images and you can be scared or whatever. So you end up in this kind of excited delirium. But you don't know anything about what's going on or what the powerful are doing. We have to build this truth movement from the bottom up. And it's got to be bigger than just our single issues, whether it's 9/11 or Israel-Palestine or propaganda or abortion or whatever side on any single issue that you're concerned about. Truth has to be much bigger than that. We have to address it. We can lay out the truth so we have access to information. We can find these things. Part of that, we're really hoping, we've been working really hard getting other universities engaged in the kind of work that we do. We have 30 affiliate universities with Project Censored worldwide. We're saying we're internationalizing. And what students will do in a classroom is they'll find an independent news story that they're interested in. They'll research it. They'll take it to a faculty member on campus who's an expert in that field. And then they'll validate that story and they'll summarize it and post it on our website as a validated news story, which becomes a candidate for one of our top 25 for the year. And we're getting input now from Spain, Germany, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Ecuador, and all over the country, Canada and the U.S. And we think that that'll grow. So we think that universities are a place where research, where fact-finding is done. And they're as much interested in that. The university is as diverse as any other population. There's people that, you know, say, how could you possibly talk about 9/11? Well, we talk about it because we've looked at factual information. And we think it's really true. We know that Building 7 falling down in 6.5 seconds is a problem. We know that Bush, the bin Laden family, being flown out of the country is a problem. That Bush staying at the school in Florida for 20 minutes after they knew what was going on, or they probably knew before, is a problem. Prior history of the hijackers linked to U.S. intelligence agencies is a problem. Pre-warnings, Abel Danger, Steve Jones, the research from Copenhagen on the nanothermite, all of these are very serious issues. And we are, again, in our 2011 book, going to cover some of the... We have a story. It'll be in the top 25. It's called Increased Tensions with Unresolved 9/11 Issues. We get right in there with Richard Gage, David Ray Griffin, Cass Sunstein, and we just pull it together and say, hey, there's still a lot of tension going on around these issues, and these are factual stories that we think are very important. Deep politics is more than, I mean, there's a couple sides of this. Now, there's certainly the side of looking at the power structures, of examining the global dominance group, which we did a couple of years ago. We put together a list of the 263 people inside of the military-industrial core that were pushing global domination of the world. That chapter is actually in David Ray Griffin's Peter Dale Scott's book on intellectual speak out. And it's our attempt to put some parameters on who they are when we start saying they did this and they did that. We got to know who they are. That's part of what deep politics is about. We have to know more about Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Halliburton, SAIC, Boeing Group, the Carlyle Group, but also the think tanks that they work with. PNAC, the Hoover Institute, American Enterprise, Hudson Institute, Heritage Foundation. You know, these are the planners, networks of people that are engaging. And let's not forget the Trilateral Commission, because most of Obama's administration is straight out of the Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission. They're like two wings of the global elite. And the more we can study that, the more we can identify who these players are and how they're involved and how they're involved with Congress. And we can show that 151 members of Congress are invested one of the top defense contractors. So they, you know, massively interlocked. And that $3.2 billion was spent lobbying Congress in 2008. That's $32,000 per day per member of Congress. And if you go there, maybe you can get to see your congressperson, but you're not certainly going to be spending $32,000 to do it. And that's corporate money. Power money, top down, control. And we know that 40% of the people in the country question 9/11, and there's a fear. The more we get labeled as conspiracy theorists, as crazy nuts, as that emerges, is an indication that, hey, we're on the right track. But there's a cost that goes with that. The state crimes against democracy piece that Mickey and I wrote, part of it was we were looking at the work by Professor Lance DeHaven Smith from Florida State University, who's part of a public administration network. And these public administrators, these people that study administrations and government processes and that, they've come up with this concept called SCAD, State Crimes Against Democracy. And that there are a number of proven crimes against democracy since World War II. McCarthyism's fabrication of communist infiltration, certainly the Gulf Tonkin Resolution, the burglary of Daniel Ellsberg's office to discredit him, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, the 2000 election felon disenfranchised process, fixing the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction. Those were lies. Those were deliberate things, and we know it. It's true. There's evidence documenting all of those. Now, other suspected scads that they write about, of course, is the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald, the shooting of George Wallace, the October surprise after the Carter administration, anthrax mailing to Daschle and Leahy, Martin Luther King's assassination, collapse of Building 7. These are scads that there's a lot of evidence that there's a real problem here, that there's some government crimes or power structure crimes, and it may not always be government, because the interlocking of corporations and government is quite intense at the highest levels. It's revolving doors. So whether it's special ops out of Lockheed Martin or special ops out of the CIA, it's still the same power structure. The term conspiracy theory is used to denigrate and discredit inquiry into state crimes against democracy. It's been used for a long time. So labeling a SCAD as a conspiracy theory is an effective method of preventing ongoing investigations from being reported in the media or anywhere else. And psychologist Lori Manuel addresses the psychological advantage that the SCAD actors hold, because research shows that people are less willing to examine information that disputes rather than confirms their beliefs. A million dead Iraqis, it couldn't be that many, but it is. And so this is what Steve Hoffman calls there must be a reason in his justification, a cognitive theory known as motivated reasoning. We tend to want to reason with what we kind of know and are motivated and believe in, what our values are, that sort of thing. And so when we get hit upside the head with something that just like contradicts it, we just want to ignore it. And this is psychological, but the actors that do these things know that. So they're very careful to make sure that they continue to say, well, that person's crazy, or Stephen Jones is discredited, or David Ray Griffin doesn't know what he's talking about, or just however they label, they'll identify us individually and do that. So we covered in this piece the thermite material at the World Trade Center, the research from the academic journal Open Chemistry, where the thermite has now been shown to be in the dust from the World Trade Center. We covered that in this piece. And we documented this. We wrote a piece for the op-ed service we had been writing for, I'd been writing for the last 6 years, called Minuteman Media. And we'd write, I'd probably written 60 op-eds for him. Except Minuteman Media was assumed and taken over by Institute for Policy Studies in Washington 6 months ago. Now, I like the Institute of Policy. They do a lot of good work. But when we submitted this op-ed, they flat said, we're not going to cover that topic. And they said, it's just unacceptable. And then they couching like, well, we don't like your writing style and stuff like that. You know, they kind of backed off saying, no, they were very topical. They said, we are not, she told me very directly, I'm not going to name names here, I'm just going to say, we were told very definitely that we don't like those truthers. They're obnoxious. They're interfering with the peace movement. Now, but listen here, now, we're laughing, but there's some images here that we have to deal with. And so our piece was censored. And so last week, it was time to send another one in. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to send in a new one. And I was written back and said, no, thank you. So we've been censored permanently from that network. When we write something, we put it up on our site. It's on 50 websites in 2 days. So millions of people see it. But that's part of the difficulty that we're faced with, particularly when we stick with a single issue. And we're adamant about our 9/11 issue, or adamant about whatever it is that we're dealing with, when the problem is much, much larger. All the people with the issues, truth emergency issues, have a common oppressor, this military-industrial media complex using U.S. military and NATO to dominate the world, and these huge mega corporations that are in all our pockets and they're everywhere and they're responsible for starvation and death and war. That's a much bigger thing.
I'm finishing there on grounds of time, and I'm going to be cutting the next piece slightly to squeeze it into the time available. It's available on the web for free download, so thank you, Scott Noble, for making it and for making it freely available.
Here in the United States, we're often brought up and told we don't have propaganda, that we have a hard-charging investigative press, we have this educated, skeptical, even cynical citizenry, and that if there were powerful interests trying to manage and manipulate public opinion, they would be exposed. The reality actually is just the opposite. Academics like Alex Carey and others who've spent their lifetimes looking at how propaganda works, finds that it's actually in Western democracies and open societies where you need the most sophisticated sorts of propaganda. And since World War I, thanks to people like Ivy Lee and Eddie Bernays, you know, propaganda has become a business, this business of public relations. Or as one of the firms that has often represented dictators. The Burson Marsteller firm puts it, their business is perception management, to manage public perception, public policy, on behalf of their clients, whoever they might be.
April 9th, 2003. Throngs of Iraqis spontaneously attack a statue of Saddam Hussein, the face obscured with old glory. Later, the stars and stripes are replaced with red, white, and black, symbolizing the transference of power from the liberators to the liberated. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld describes the scenes as breathtaking. For the British Army, they are historic. BBC Radio calls them amazing. And they were, because the entire event was staged. Years after the operation, a U.S. Army report admitted that the toppling of the Saddam statue had been engineered by a psychological operations group. The document states, "Our TPT, or Tactical PSYOP team, saw the statue as a target of opportunity." A week earlier, another psychological operation laid the groundwork for what followed. The script was for a female Rambo turned damsel in distress to be rescued by U.S. armed forces.
In the situation that we're talking about here with Private Lynch, as you know, on about the 23rd of March, her 507th maintenance company was ambushed. A number of the members of that maintenance company were killed, a number were captured, and a number were unaccounted for, she being one of them.
We waited 24 hours to get the cameras there to set up the whole thing to make this big rescue, and the SWAT team goes in to save her, and then she becomes an instant celebrity overnight. That story happened the same day that the tanks were rolling into Baghdad. That's the same day that we shelled the Palestine Hotel where the independent journalists were. The same day we blew up Al Jazeera's television station and killed one of their journalists. All we're getting on the front pages of the papers and in the news is the rescue of Jessica Lynch. So that was a PR substitute story. Toppling this statue, they got Shalabi's group. The Renan group had actually formed them. The CIA had paid the Renan group to form the Iraqi Congress as a countergroup to Saddam Hussein, and they were based here in the U.S. Then they flew them over there and they shipped them into Iraq. They were the ones that were standing around the statue as, you know, a tank was used to pull it over. The Renan group had been around. He worked for George W.'s father, and he worked for Clinton, too. He used to be a public relations press guy for Carter, and he created a PR firm that specialized in the war.
The head of the Rendon Group, John Rendon, denies that he is a national security strategist or a military tactician. Rather, he states, "I am a politician and a person who uses communication to meet public policy or corporate policy objectives. In fact, I am an information warrior and a perception manager." Following the first Gulf War, Rendon was paid $23 million by the CIA to create anti-Saddam propaganda. Following 9/11, he was charged with public relations for the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Rendon is far from alone. Public relations has mushroomed into a $200 billion a year industry, with PR flacks in the United States now outnumbering journalists. Propaganda has become the primary means by which the wealthy communicate with the rest of society. Whether selling a product, a political candidate, a law, or a war, seldom do the powerful deliver messages to the public before consulting their colleagues in the public relations industry. Colin Powell presents a now typical case. He didn't choose a seasoned diplomat for the position of Under Secretary of State. Instead, he chose Charlotte Beers, known in PR circles as the Queen of Madison Avenue. Her resume includes successful advertising campaigns for Head & Shoulders Dander Shampoo, Uncle Ben's Rice, and now Uncle Sam.
You see a news show, you watch 60 Minutes or a Fox program or whatever it is, you tend to give more credibility to what you're told is journalism. If an advertisement comes on, hopefully you tend to be more skeptical of that, because obviously somebody put an awful lot of money into crafting this slick TV ad and airing it. But what you probably never suspect is that news story you just watched was also crafted by a company given to the TV station or network with the understanding that they would put their own logos on it, identify it as real journalism, and air it.
Colonel Sam Gardner would eventually chart 50 false news stories created and leaked by the Bush White House propaganda apparatus prior to and during the assault on Iraq. Foremost amongst these were the lies that led to the war in the first place. It was not bad intelligence that led to the invasion, concludes Gardner. It was an orchestrated effort that began before the war and was meticulously planned to manipulate the public.
John Stauber, PR Watch.
In 2002, when the Bush administration was conducting its massive public relations campaign to sell the war, out of Donald Rumsfeld's office in the Pentagon, there was something now referred to as the Pentagon Pundits Program, where literally scores of former high-ranking military generals and admirals and colonels were getting their talking points for their appearances on TV news shows directly from the Pentagon. They would literally go to the Pentagon, be on phone conferences with the Pentagon, travel with the Pentagon, and then go on TV as supposedly independent sources. Although most of them were actually being paid in the private sector, because these are retired military officials, by defense contractors, and many of them were actually registered lobbyists for military contractors. So there's a bit of a conflict of interest right away when your bread and butter is based on being able to sell armaments and bombs and missiles, and you're supposed to be just a patriotic ex-general giving an honest opinion of what's going on. And even though that's illegal, there's no way to really stop it. And the most powerful medium through which it occurred refuses to even report on the scandal. You've got just a massive problem, and that's where we're at.
There were clear warning signs long before the age of the Invad. During the assault on Serbia under President Clinton, a report emerged by the Dutch journalist Abe de Vries, revealing the presence of Psy warriors working at CNN. They derived from the 3rd Psychological Operations Battalion at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. De Vries quoted Major Thomas Collins of the U.S. Army Information Service. PSYOPs personnel, soldiers, and officers have been working in CNN's headquarters in Atlanta through our program, training with industry. They helped in the production of news. What made the Iraq War different were not so much the tactics or even the scale, but the high-tech synergy. It was almost impossible to tell where the state ended and the Fourth Estate began.
One of the things that we don't want to do is to destroy the infrastructure of Iraq, because in a few days we're going to own that country.
Should they have used more? Should they, you know, use a Moab, the mother of all bombs, and a few daisy cutters, and, you know, let's not just stop at a couple of cruise missiles.
Yeah, only one.
The invasion of Iraq represents a pinnacle of domestic Psy war in the United States, an unparalleled integration between public relations firms, corporate media, and military psyops. At the time of the assault, large segments of the American public were convinced that a nuclear attack by Saddam Hussein on their nation was not only possible, but imminent. Soldiers who comprised the invading force were similarly confused, with a remarkable 77% believing that Hussein was responsible for the attacks of 9/11. Many earnestly believed that the mission was to destroy a mysterious group known as Al-Qaeda while bringing freedom to the Iraqi people. Yet what was actually happening was what the Nuremberg Charter describes as the single greatest crime under international law: the planning, preparation, initiation, or waging of a war of aggression. Seven years later, the results of the invasion are clear. According to The Lancet, one of Britain's most respected medical journals, approximately 600,000 Iraqis had been killed from the invasion as of 2006. By 2009, a polling agency put the number at over 1 million. 4 million Iraqis have been made refugees in their own country. Their entire society is shattered. How did the land of the free and the home of the brave arrive at a place where citizens could be manipulated with such efficiency and on such a massive scale? Our story begins in an unlikely place, a coal mine. When we think of public relations, this is not an image that springs to mind. Yet it was here, at the turn of the century, in the town of Ludlow, Colorado, that PR as we know it began to take shape. From the beginning, it was steeped in class warfare.
The conditions that men, women, and children worked under in 19th century America were very much like what we think of now as the conditions in the global South, in which 13, 14-hour days were not uncommon. Living conditions were often in barrack-like housing. Children worked right alongside their parents. Those were the kind of conditions, and certainly if you picture what we see in the global South today, almost slave-like conditions, you can make the comparison pretty easily.
Like workers in most other industries at the time, the coal miners in the town of Ludlow were organizing to win basic rights. In 1914, the United Mine Workers Union called for coal companies to grant safe working conditions, tolerable wages, and compliance with state mining laws. In response, a labor organizer at Ludlow was shot to death by gunmen working for the Colorado Fuel and Iron Corporation, owned by the Rockefeller family. Then as now, the Rockefellers were synonymous with wealth and power. William Avery Rockefeller had made a living as a literal snake oil salesman, but his son, John Davidson, had achieved the American dream. His fortune was built by exploiting oil reserves in Mexico and the United States. John Davidson Rockefeller was America's first billionaire, but it was his son, John D. Jr., who would define the Rockefeller legacy in the 20th century. 24 hours after striking workers and their families celebrated Easter, the end came. It became known as the Ludlow Massacre.
Howard Zinn, historian.
The strike went on from the fall of 1913 to the spring of 1914, and they still couldn't break the strike. The strikers were living in tent colonies set up by their union, the United Mine Workers. And in April of 1914, the National Guard, which at this time was being paid by the Rockefellers, National Guard attacked the tent colony. Men, women, children, killed many people, set the tents afire. They found the next day the bodies of 11 children and 2 women, who were burned, suffocated to death in that fire. That was called the Ludlow Massacre.
A brief glance at events prior to Ludlow reveals that the brutalization of workers in the United States was not an unusual occurrence. 60 years earlier, in 1847, a nationwide general strike was met with violent oppression by federal troops. Over 30 workers were killed and 100 wounded at the Battle of the Viaduct in Chicago. In 1894, federal troops killed 34 American Railway Union members, also in the Chicago area. The troops were attempting to break a strike led by Eugene Debs against the Pullman Company. In 1897, 19 unarmed coal miners were killed and 36 wounded by a posse organized by a sheriff near Latimer, Pennsylvania. Most of the workers were shot in the back while attempting to flee. The worldview of the great capitalists at the turn of the century can be summed up in the words of William Vanderbilt. In response to a suggestion that the New York Central Railroad should adjust its train schedules to accommodate the public, he replied, "The public be damned." But the relationship between the public and corporations was changing. Decades of organizing and rebellion had given rise to a vast network of labor groups with increasing political power. Over time, these included the Grange Movement, the Socialist Party, the Greenbackers, the Populists, and Progressives, and perhaps most significantly, the Anarchist Union, known as the Industrial Workers of the World, or the Wobblies. Following the massacre at Ludlow, soldiers in Denver refused to participate in further attacks against the miners, declaring that they would not engage in the shooting of women and children. Demonstrations erupted across the country. A march occurred in front of the Rockefeller offices in New York City. A clergyman protested outside a church where Rockefeller liked to give sermons, only to be beaten by police. In modern parlance, it was a PR nightmare.
Ivy Lee went to work for, among other clients, the Rockefellers. The Rockefeller family, after the Ludlow massacre, used Eddie Lee to manage the public perception around that event and other events. Ivy Lee's specialty was crisis management. Among other things, he's credited with inventing the press release, which, you know, all of us just sort of think of as something helpful. You want to publicize an event, a church picnic, call a news conference, you put out a press release. But at the time, the idea was very radical, because what Ivy Lee was saying is, well, we're going to manage this crisis by calling attention to it. We're going to actually assist and help the news media and journalists in covering it. What he knew was that the degree to which journalists became used to and dependent on his services was the degree to which he could actually cultivate and manage coverage.
Lee began by waging a disinformation campaign. He put out news bulletins claiming that the two women and 11 children at Ludlow had not been killed by militia, but by an overturned stove. He circulated stories suggesting that Mother Jones, in addition to being a labor organizer, was a madam who ran a bordello. He ghostwrote letters to the governor and even to President Wilson. Lee's techniques achieved little success, in part because he himself had become a highly visible figure. In future, PR experts would learn that their techniques are rarely effective unless practiced in the dark. Yet one of Lee's innovations was epoch-making. Upon learning that the Rockefeller Foundation had $100 million set aside for promotional purposes, he convinced Rockefeller to donate large sums to colleges, hospitals, churches, and charitable organizations in order to generate positive publicity. He also suggested that Rockefeller Sr. begin handing out money in public, and that Junior appear in staged photo ops at work sites. What Ivy Lee understood was that the corporation needed a makeover. Widely perceived as greedy, tyrannical institutions, corporations needed to manufacture an image of warmth and caring.
This is the beginning of the public relations industry. Rockefeller didn't set up the Rockefeller Foundation until Rockefeller became very unpopular because of his labor policies. And suddenly Rockefeller needed to create a good impression.
Richard Conniff, author of A Natural History of the Rich.
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon that the poor actually give a larger percentage of their income than the rich. I think the rich feel that they're doing more because, you know, giving $100,000 seems like a substantial kind of donation, and you know, it doesn't matter that they have $100 million, they still think, well, they've done quite a lot. So it's partly a result of this distortion of economic values, and it's partly a result of being cheap. You know, I mean, people don't want to give away their wealth, Ted Turner said, because they're afraid their status in the Forbes 400 is going to go down that little bit. So they give it away when it's prudent, or when it's beneficial, when they can get some display benefit out of it, or when it can give them access to a different sort of social class or a different group that they want to be part of. But they have a more functional view of their wealth rather than a strictly charitable view.
Charity, and private charity, and you might say government charity. Any kind of action that sort of relieves people's distress a little bit without changing the system, maintains the system. In fact, that is the way the American system, which is very exploitative and very unfair, that's the way the American system has been maintained for all these centuries, really, by giving people a little bit and giving enough people, just enough, to prevent them from breaking out in open rebellion.
Today, one of the largest PR firms in the world specializes in the art of crisis management. Burson Marsteller holds offices in 35 countries and has served clients as varied as cigarette maker Philip Morris, chemical giant Union Carbide, and the Monsanto Corporation, a company specializing in genetic engineering and other life sciences. Like the Rendon Group, Burson Marsteller is bipartisan to the core. Its worldwide president and chief executive, Mark Penn, served as Hillary Clinton's key political advisor during the 2008 election. The most disturbing facet of Burson Marsteller is its willingness to work with the world's worst human rights violators. They ran PR for the Indonesian government as it committed genocide in East Timor. They worked closely with the Nigerian government and Royal Dutch Shell during and after the Biafran War in Nigeria, and they helped to improve the image of a U.S.-backed Argentine military junta led by General Jorge Videla.
One of their clients in the 1970s was the brutal Argentine junta, which had taken control of the government there and was rounding up dissidents, systematically torturing, beating, killing people, and flying out over the ocean and dumping bodies. Not a really good public image. So the Burson Marsteller firm was used by Argentina, hired by Argentina, and went to work for them quite happily under a FAB contract to improve the image of Argentina in the international financial community and in the Western press.
In some ways, it should not be surprising that public relations has evolved into companies like Burson Marsteller and the Rendon Group. Looking back at the career of its first guru, we find a remarkably similar pattern.
Ivy Lee went to work for the IG Farben company, a big German industrial company, and we know now that IG Farben was actually part of the Nazi propaganda inner circle. One of the most effective and, of course, horrifying government propaganda campaigns ever organized was the Nazi campaign that continued for years and years under the direction of Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. And IG Farben paid Ivy Lee and also paid Ivy Lee's son to represent not just their interests, but the interests of Nazi Germany in an effort to paint the Nazi regime as being a friendly regime.
But before lending his expertise to the Third Reich, Mr. Lee would do so for the American government. Along with other experts in the burgeoning field of mind science and public relations, he would engineer propaganda for World War I, not just against the enemy, the Germans, but against the American people themselves.
Graham McQueen, co-founder of the Center for Peace Studies.
We often talk about the propaganda being relatively recent, but of course it isn't. Even in ancient societies that weren't democratic, especially large states, it was understood by elites that if you don't have the support of the people, you could be in trouble. And so a fair bit of attention was actually given to legitimizing military adventures. I'm remembering here a passage from an old Chinese text, I think it's Han Feizi, so it would be about 2,300 years ago, where the author of the book says, in general, and I'm quoting now, in general, war is a thing that the people despise. Therefore, when a young man is to be sent off to war, his wife, his parents, his family should gather around him and say to him, conquer, or let me never see you again. And this is a very powerful sense of, well, first of all, the violence done to that young man, but also of the sense that war is disgusting to most people, and it is often not in their best interest. And therefore, one needs all kinds of songs and dances. And in this case, threatening the young man essentially with dispossession. You can't return to your family. You can't return home. You'll be disgraced. Honor, security, everything is being played upon her. And it continues. So yeah, national security is one of the most powerful notions in modern times. To swindle, I think, people, to do things that are not in their best interest, and to support massive military complexes that are not in anybody's interest, but that are like cancers feeding on society frequently.
Christopher Simpson, author of The Science of Coercion.
Propaganda and persuasion have been around for centuries, eons. But propaganda in its modern sense can be traced to the 15th and 16th century, when the Catholic Church was in a tough competition with the Protestants over how to articulate a religious vision for the world. And the reason that I mention this is that it shows that propaganda is about mindset. It's about ideology. It's about worldview, how people see things, as distinct from an individual policy or whether you happen to like this candidate or that candidate. So that's where the word came from, for propagating the faith. And that's the way the word was used up until the early 20th century. And then what emerged, particularly with World War I, was the application of this propagating the faith to refer to international affairs, to refer to what a national government would do, a national security policy. In the run-up to World War I and during World War I, what one saw on the geopolitical stage was a crisis of empires. Empires were disintegrating, they were falling apart. The British Empire seemed extremely strong at that time, and yet nevertheless was in a downward phase. It couldn't afford to support its own army, for example. Same with the French, same with the Austro-Hungarians, same with the Russians, the Tsarist Empire, same with the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and so on around the world. When that war was underway, most particularly the United Kingdom came up with an office whose specific purpose was promoting the war aims of the United Kingdom, the English, through publicity, through covert operations, through what would today be called dirty tricks, through telling the truth, through a whole number of different applications of information, using information as an instrument of war. And from the get-go, from the very beginning, it was both aimed at the enemy and aimed at the home population.
The Creel Commission was the American variant of it. Woodrow Wilson came into office in 1916 with the slogan, "Peace without victory." He said, "What we want is an end to World War I. Neither side deserves their support." And the population didn't want to enter the war.
In America, 1916 was an election year. The war was the dominant issue. The election campaigns of the parties crystallized the sway of opinion. Neutralism, the profound wish to stay out of the war, still possessed a doughty champion in the president. Support for Wilson's policy was strong in the Middle West and Pacific states. Europe's war seemed more remote there than on the Atlantic seaboard. At the Democratic Convention, Wilson was renominated presidential candidate. The chairman opened his speech with a text from the Sermon on the Mount.
"Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God."
Within a couple of months, Wilson was talking about victory without peace. And you had to somehow drive the population into accepting this sharp change of policy, the opposite of what they voted for. And that's where the Creel Commission came in.
George Creel described his work with unabashed enthusiasm. It was a plain publicity proposition, a vast enterprise in salesmanship, the world's greatest adventure in advertising. 75,000 civil leaders, known as Four Minute Men, were assembled to deliver pro-war messages to people in churches, theaters, and civic groups. Periodicals were sent to 600,000 teachers. Boy Scouts delivered copies of President Wilson's addresses to households across America.